Chapter 52. Boots. Elaine settled herself in Glimmer's saddle. The mare was one of the prizes of the royal stable. She was of fine Saldean stock, with a brilliant white mane and coat. The saddle itself was rich, the leather trimmed with wine red and gold. It was the sort of saddle you used when parading. Birgitta rode Rising, a tall dun gelding, also one of the fastest in the royal stables. The warder had chosen both horses. She expected to have to run. Birgitta wore one of Elaine's foxhead copies, though it had a different shape, a thin silver disc with a rose on the front. Elaine carried another wrapped in cloth inside her pocket. She tried making another this morning, but it had melted, nearly setting her dresser on fire. She was having a great deal of difficulty without the original to study. Her dreams of arming all of her personal guards with medallions was looking less and less possible, unless she somehow managed to persuade Matt to give her the original again. Her honor guard fell into mounted ranks around her and Birgitta in the Queen's Plaza. She was bringing only 100 soldiers, 75 guardsmen and an inner ring of 25 guardswomen. It was a tiny force, but she'd have gone without those 100 if she'd been able to get away with it. She couldn't afford to be seen as a conqueror.
"I don't like this," Birgitta said.
"You don't like anything lately," Elaine said. "I swear you're becoming more irritable by the day."
"It's because you're becoming more foolhardy by the day."
"Oh, come now. This is hardly the most foolhardy thing I've done."
"Only because you've set a very high benchmark for yourself, Elaine."
"It will be fine," Elaine said, glancing southward.
"Why do you keep looking in that direction?"
"Rand," Elaine said, feeling that warmth again, pulsing from the knot of emotions in her mind. "He's getting ready for something. He feels troubled and peaceful at the same time. Light, but that man could be confusing." The meeting would happen in one day, if his original deadline still held. Egwene was right. Breaking the seals would be foolish, but Rand would see reason. Elise rode up to her, accompanied by 3 kinswomen. Serasia was a plump woman with a grandmotherly air. Dark-skinned Kima kept her black hair in 3 long braids, and prim Nashia, with a youthful face, wore a baggy dress. The 4 took up positions beside Elaine. Only 2 of them were strong enough for a gateway. Many of the kin were weaker than most Aes Sedai, but that would be enough, assuming Elaine had trouble embracing the source.
"Can you do something to prevent archers from hitting her?" Birgitta asked Elise. "Some kind of weave?"
Elise cocked her head thoughtfully.
"I know of one that might help," she said, "but I've never tried it."
Another kinswoman wove a gateway up ahead. It opened to a span of rough, brown-grassed land outside of Cairhien. A much larger army waited there, wearing the cuirasses and bell-shaped helmets of Cairhienan troops. The officers were easy to spot with their dark clothing, in the colors of the houses they served. They wore Khan Rising over their backs. Tall, narrow-faced Lorstrom sat at the front of his army, which wore dark green with crimson slashes. Bertome was on the other side. Their forces looked to be about the same size, 5,000 each. The other 4 houses had fielded smaller armies.
"If they wanted to take you captive," Birgitta said grimly, "you're handing them the chance."
"There's no way to do this and remain safe. Not unless I want to hide in my palace and send my troops in. That would only lead to rebellion in Cairhien and potential collapse in Andor." She glanced at the warder. "I'm queen now, Birgitta. You're not going to be able to keep me from danger, no more than you could keep a lone soldier safe on the battlefield."
Birgitta nodded. "Stay close to me and Gaibon."
Gaibon approached on a large, dappled gelding. With Birgitta on one side of her and Gaibon on the other, and with both of their horses taller than Elaine's,
a would-be assassin would have great difficulty picking her off without first hitting her friends. So it would be for the rest of her life. She nudged Glimmer into motion, and her troop made its way through the gateway and onto Kyrianin soil. The noblemen and noblewomen ahead bowed or curtsied from horseback, and those oblations were deeper this time than they had been when meeting Elaine in her throne room. The show had begun. The city was just ahead, walls still blackened from fires during the fight with the Shido. Elaine could sense Birgitta's tension as the gateway vanished behind. The kin around Elaine embraced the source, and Elise wove an unfamiliar weave, placing it in the air around the inner ring of troops. It made a small but swift wind spinning in the air. Birgitta's anxiety was contagious, and Elaine found herself holding her reins in a tight grip. Glimmer moved forward. The air was drier here in Kyrian, with a faint dusty scent to it. The sky was overcast. The Kyrianin troops formed around her small group of Andorans in white and red. Most of the Kyrianin forces were foot, though there was some heavy cavalry, horses in shiny barding, and men carrying lances pointed high into the air. All marched in perfect lines, protecting Elaine, or keeping her captive. Lorstrom moved his bay stallion closer to Elaine's outer ranks. Gaibon glanced at her and she nodded, so the captain allowed him to approach.
"The city is nervous, Your Majesty," Lorstrom said.
Birgitta was still careful to keep her mount between his and Elaine's.
"There are unfortunate rumors surrounding your ascension."
"Rumors you probably initiated," Elaine thought, "before you decided to support me instead. Surely they won't rise against your troops?"
"I hope they will not."
He eyed her from under his flat cap of forest green. He wore a civilian dress, a black coat that went down to his knees, and slashes of color across it all the way down to denote his house. It was the type of clothing he'd wear if going to a ball. That projected a sense of confidence. His force wasn't seizing the city. It was escorting the new queen with an honorary parade.
"It is unlikely that there will be armed resistance, but I wanted to warn you."
Lorstrom nodded to her with respect. He knew how she was manipulating him, but he also accepted that manipulation. She would have to keep a careful watch on him in the years to come. Kyrian was such a boxish city, all straight lines and fortified towers. Though there was a beauty to some of its architecture, there was no comparing it to Camelin or Tar Valon. They rode directly in through the northern gates, the river Alguenia to their right. Crowds waited inside. Lorstrom and the others had done their work well. There were cheers, probably started by carefully placed courtiers. As Elaine entered the city, the cheers grew louder. That surprised her. She had expected hostility. And yes, there was some of that, the occasional thrown piece of refuse hurled from the back of the crowd. She caught a jeer here and there, but most seemed pleased. As she rode down that broad passageway, lined with the rectangular buildings Kyrianin favored, she realized that perhaps these people had been waiting for an event like this. Talking of it, spreading tales. Some of those tales had been hostile, and those were what Nari had reported. But they now seemed to her more a sign of worry than hostility. Kyrian had been too long without a monarch, their king dead by unknown hands, the Lord Dragon seemingly abandoning them. Her confidence grew. Kyrian was a wounded city, the burned and broken remnants of the foregate outside. Cobbles had been torn up to be thrown from the walls. The city had never fully recovered from the Aiel War, and the unfinished topless towers, symmetrical in design but woefully forlorn in appearance, were a lofty declaration of that fact. That bloody game of houses was nearly as bad a scourge. Could she change that? The people around her sounded hopeful, as if they knew what a twisted mess their nation had become. One could sooner take away an Aiel's spears than cut the craftiness out of the Kyrianan, but perhaps she could teach them a greater loyalty to country and throne, so long as they had a throne worth that loyalty. The Sun Palace stood at the exact center of the city. Like the rest of the city, it was square and angular, but here the architecture gave a sense of imposing strength. It was a grand building, despite the broken wing where the attempt on Rand's life had taken place. More nobles waited here, standing on covered steps or in front of ornate carriages, women in formal gowns with wide hoops, the men in neat coats of dark colors, caps on their heads. Many looked skeptical, and some amazed. Elaine shot Birgitta a satisfied smile. It's working. Nobody expected me to ride to the palace, escorted by a Kyrianan army. Birgitta said nothing. She was still tense, and probably would be until Elaine returned to Camelin. Two women stood at the foot of the steps, one a pretty woman with bells in her hair, the other with curly hair and a face that did not seem Aes Sedai, for all the fact that she had been one for years. That was Sachal Anderley, and the other woman, who did have an ageless face, was Samitsu Tamagawa. From what Elaine's sources had been able to determine, these two were as close to rulers as the city had in Rand's absence. She'd corresponded with both, and found Sachal remarkably keen at understanding the Kyrianan way of thinking. She'd offered Elaine the city, but had implied that she understood that being offered it and taking it were two different things. Sachal stepped forward. "Your Majesty," she said formally, "let it be known that the Lord Dragon gives you all rights and claim to this land. All formal control he had over the land is ceded to you, and the position of steward over the nation is dissolved. May you rule in wisdom and peace." Elaine nodded to her regally from horseback, but inside she seethed. She'd said she didn't mind Rand's help taking this throne, but it wasn't like she wanted her nose rubbed in it. Still, Sachal seemed to take her position seriously, though from what Elaine had discovered, that position was in large measure self-created. Elaine and her procession dismounted. Had Rand thought that it would be as easy as that to give her the throne? He'd stayed in Kyrian long enough to know how they schemed. One Aes Sedai making a proclamation would never have been enough, but having powerful nobles support her directly should be enough to do it. Their procession made its way up the steps. They entered, and each of those supporting her brought a smaller honor guard of 50. Elaine brought her entire force. It was crowded, but she didn't intend to leave any behind. The inner hallways were straight, with peaked ceilings and golden trim. The symbol of the rising sun emblazoned each door. There were alcoves for riches to be displayed, but many were empty. Looting Aiel had taken their fifth from this palace. Upon reaching the entrance to the Grand Hall of the Sun, Elaine's Andoran guardsmen and guardswomen arranged themselves, lining the outer hallway. Elaine took a deep breath, then strode into the throne room with a group of 10. Blue-streaked marble columns rose to the ceiling at the sides of the room, and the sun throne sat on its blue marble dais at the back of the large hall. The seat was of gilded wood, but was surprisingly unassuming. Perhaps that was why Layman had decided to build himself a new throne, using Avandoral Dera itself as a material. Elaine walked up to the dais, then turned as the Kyrianan nobility entered, her supporters first, then the others, ranked according to the complicated dictates of Desdemar. Those rankings could change by the day, if not the hour. Birgitta eyed each one who entered, but the Kyrianan were models of propriety. None would show anything like Elorian's audacity in Andor. She was a patriot, if one who frustratingly continued to disagree with Elaine. In Kyrian, one did not do such things. Once the crowd had stilled, Elaine took a deep breath. She'd considered a speech, but her mother had taught her that sometimes decisive action made for the best speech. Elaine moved to sit down in the throne. Birgitta caught her arm. Elaine glanced at her questioningly, but the warder was eyeing the throne. "Wait a moment," she said, bending down. The nobles began murmuring one to another, and Lorstrom stepped up to Elaine. "Your Majesty?"
"Birgitta," Elaine said, blushing, "is this really necessary?"
Birgitta ignored her, prodding at the seat's cushion. Light! Was the warder determined to embarrass her in every possible situation? Surely the—
"Aha!"
Birgitta said, yanking something from the pillowed cushion. Elaine started, then stepped closer, Lorstrom and Bertome at her side. Birgitta was holding up a small needle, tipped black.
"Hidden in the cushion."
Elaine paled.
"It was the only place they knew you'd be, Elaine," Birgitta said softly.
She knelt down and began prodding for more traps. Lorstrom had grown flushed.
"I will find who did this, Your Majesty," he said in a low voice, a dangerous voice. "They will know my wrath." "Not if they know mine first,"
Stocky Bertome said, looking over the needle.
"Obviously an assassination attempt intended for the Lord Dragon, Your Majesty," Lorstrom said in a louder voice for the benefit of the audience. "None would dare try to kill you, our beloved sister from Andor."
"That is good to hear," Elaine said, eyeing him.
That expression of hers said to everyone in the room that she would put up with this ruse, intended to save his face. As her strongest supporter, the shame of an assassination attempt fell on him. Agreeing to let him save face would cost him. He lowered his eyes briefly in understanding. Light, she hated this game, but she would play it, and she would play it well.
"Is it safe?" she asked Birgitta.
The warder rubbed her chin.
"One way to find out," she said, then plopped herself down in the throne with an unceremonious amount of force.
Not a few of the nobles in the hall gasped, and Lorstrom grew more pale.
"Not very comfortable," Birgitta said, leaning to the side, then pushing her back up against the wood. "I would have expected a monarch's throne to be more cushioned, what with your delicate backside and all."
"Birgitta," Elaine hissed, feeling her face grow red again. "You can't sit in the sun throne."
"I'm your bodyguard," Birgitta said. "I can taste your food if I want. I can walk through doorways before you. And I can bloody sit in your chair if I think it will protect you."
She grinned. "Besides," she added in a lower voice, "I always wondered what one of these felt like." The warder stood up, still wary but also satisfied. Elaine turned and faced the nobility of Kyrian. "You have waited long for this," she said. "Some of you are dissatisfied, but remember that half of my blood is Kyrianan. This alliance will make both of our nations great. I do not demand your trust, but I do demand your obedience." She hesitated, then added, "Remember again, this is as the Dragon Reborn wishes it to be." She saw that they understood. Rand had conquered this city once, though it had been to liberate it from the Shido. They would be wise not to tempt him to come back and conquer it again. A queen used the tools that she had at hand. She had taken Andor on her own. She would let Rand help her with Kyrian. She sat down. Such a simple thing, but the implications would be far-reaching indeed. "Gather your individual forces and house guards," she commanded to the collected nobles. "You will be marching with the forces of Andor through gateways to a place known as the Field of Merilor. We will be meeting the Dragon Reborn." The nobles seemed surprised. She would come in, take the throne, then command their armies from the city the same day? She smiled. Best to act quickly and decisively. It would build precedent for obeying her, and would begin to ready them for the last battle. "Also," she announced as they began to whisper. I want you to gather every man in this realm who can hold a sword and conscript them into the Queen's army. There won't be much time for training, but every man will be needed in the last battle, and those women who wish to fight may report as well. Also send word to the bell founders in your city. I will need to meet with them within the hour.
But, Bertome said, the coronation feast, your majesty.
We will feast when the last battle has been won, and Kyrian's children are safe, Elaine said. She needed to distract them from their plots, give them work to keep them busy if possible. Move! Pretend the last battle is on your doorstep and will arrive on the morrow. For indeed it might.
Matt leaned against a dead tree, looking over his camp. He breathed in and out, smiling, feeling the beautiful comfort of knowing that he was no longer being chased. He had forgotten how good that felt. Better than a pretty serving girl on each knee, that feeling was. Well, better than one serving girl, anyway. A military camp at evening was one of the most comfortable places in all the world, even if half the camp was empty, the men there having gone to Kyrian. The sun had set, and some of those who remained had turned in. But for those who had pulled afternoon duty the next day, there was no reason to sleep just yet. A dozen fire pits smoldered through the camp, men sitting to share tales of exploits, of women left behind, or of rumors from far off. Tongues of flame flickered as men laughed, sitting on logs or rocks, someone occasionally digging into the coals with a twisted branch and stirring tiny sparks into the air as his friends sang Come Ye Maids or Fallen Willows at noon. The men of the band were from a dozen different nations, but this camp was their true home. Matt strode through them, hat on his head, Ashandarai over his shoulder. He had gotten a new scarf for his neck. People knew about his scar, but there was no reason to show it off like one of Luca's bloody wagons. The scarf he had chosen this time was red, in memory of Tylin and the others who had fallen to the Golam. For a short time, he had been tempted to choose pink. A very short time. Matt smiled. Though there were songs ringing from several of the campfires, none were loud, and there was a healthy stillness about the camp. Not a silence. Silence was never good. He hated silence. Made him wonder who was trying so hard to sneak up on him. No, this was a stillness. Men snoring softly, fires crackling, voices singing, weeds crunching as those on watch passed by. The peaceful noises of men enjoying their lives. Matt found his way back to his table outside his darkened tent. He sat down, looking over the papers he had stacked there. The inside of the tent had been too stuffy. Besides, he had not wanted to wake Alvar. Matt's tent rippled in the wind. His seat did look odd, the fine oak table sitting in a patch of hen's foot, Matt's chair beside it, a pitcher of mulled cider on the ground beside him. The papers on his table were weighted down with various rocks he had picked up, lit by a single flickering lamp. He should not have to have stacks of paper. He should be able to sit at one of those fires and sing Dance with Jack of the Shadows. He could faintly make out the words of the song from a nearby campfire. Papers. Well, he had agreed to Elaine's employment, and there were papers for that sort of thing. And papers about setting up the dragon cruise, papers about supplies, discipline reports, and all kinds of nonsense. And a few papers he had been able to wiggle out of Her Royal Majesty. Spy reports he had wanted to look over. Reports on the Seanchan. Much of the news was not new to him. By courtesy of Varen's gateway, Matt had traveled to Camelin more quickly than most rumors. But Elaine had gateways of her own. And some of the news from Tyr or Ilion was fresh. There was talk of the new Seanchan Empress. So Tuon really had crowned herself, or whatever it was the Seanchan did to name a new leader. That made him smile. Light, but they did not know what they were in for. They probably thought they did, but she would surprise them sure as the sky was blue. Or, well, it had been gray lately. There was also talk of sea folk in alliance with the Shan Chan. Nat dismissed that. The Shan Chan had captured enough sea folk vessels to give that impression, but it was not the truth. He found some pages with news about Rand, too, most of it unspecific or untrustworthy. Blasted colors. Rand was sitting around and talking with some people in a tent. Perhaps he was in Ar-Adaman. But he could not be both there and fighting in the borderlands now, could he? One rumor said that Rand had killed Queen Tylin. Which bloody idiots thought that? He turned over the reports on Rand quickly. He hated having to banish those flaming colors over and over again. At least Rand was wearing clothes this time. The last page was curious. Wolves running in enormous packs, congregating in clearings and howling in chorus. The skies shining red at night. Livestock lining up in the fields, all facing toward the north, watching silently. The footprints of Shadowspawn armies in the middle of fields. These things smelled of simple hearsay, passed on from farm wife to farm wife until they reached the ears of Elaine's spies. Matt looked over the sheet, then, without even thinking of it, realized he had pulled Baron's envelope out of his pocket. The still-sealed letter was looking worn and dirty, but he had not opened it. It seemed like the most difficult thing he had ever done, resisting that urge. "Now that is a sight of some irregularity," a woman's voice said. Matt looked up to see Satala strolling toward him. She wore a brown dress that laced over her ample bosom. Not that Matt spent any time looking at it. "You like my den?" Matt asked. He set the envelope aside, then put the last of the spy reports on a stack, just beside a series of sketches he'd been doing on some new crossbows, based on the ones Talmanis had bought. The papers threatened to blow away. As he had no rock for this stack, he pulled off one of his boots and set it on the top. "Your den?" Satala asked, sounding amused. "Sure," Matt said, scratching the bottom of his stockinged foot. "You'll have to make an appointment with my steward if you want to come in."
"Your steward?"
"The stump right over there," Matt said, nodding. "Not the little one. The big one with moss growing up on the top." She raised an eyebrow. "He's quite good," Matt said. "Hardly ever lets anyone in I don't want to see."
"You are an interesting creature, Matram Cawthon," Satala said, seating herself on the larger stump. Her dress was after the Ebudar style, with the side pinned up to reveal petticoats colorful enough to scare away a tinker.
"Did you want anything specific?" Matt asked. "Or did you just drop by so that you could sit on my steward's head?"
"I heard that you visited the palace again today. Is it true that you know the queen?"
Matt shrugged.
"Elaine's a nice enough girl. Pretty thing, that's for certain." "You don't shock me anymore, Matram Cawthon," Satala noted. "I've realized that the things you say are often intended to do that."
"They were?"
"I say what I'm thinking, Mistress Annan. Why does it matter to you if I know the queen?"
"Merely another piece of the puzzle that you represent," Satala said. "I received a letter from Jolene today."
"What did she want from you?"
"She didn't ask for anything. She merely wanted to send word that they had arrived safely in Tarvalen."
"You must have read it wrong."
Satala gave him a chiding stare.
"Jolene Sedai respects you, Master Cawthon. She often spoke highly of you, and the way that you rescued not only her, but the other two. She asked after you in the letter."
Matt blinked.
"Really? She said things like that?"
Satala nodded.
"Burn me," he said. "Almost makes me feel bad for painting her mouth blue. But you wouldn't have known she thought that way, considering how she treated me."
"Speaking such things to a man inflates his opinion of himself. One would think that the way she treated you would have been enough."
"She's Aes Sedai," Matt muttered.
She treats everyone like they're mud to be scraped off her boots.
Sitala glared at him. She had a stately way about her, part grandmother, part court lady, part no-nonsense innkeeper. Sorry, he said. Some Aes Sedai aren't as bad as others. I didn't mean to insult you.
I'll take that for a compliment, Sitala said. Though I'm not Aes Sedai.
Matt shrugged, finding a nice small rock at his feet. He used it to replace his boot atop the stack of paper. The rains of the last few days had passed, leaving a crisp freshness to the air.
I know you said it didn't hurt, Matt said. But what does it feel like? The thing you lost.
She pursed her lips.
What is the most delightful food you enjoy, Master Cawthon? The one thing that you would eat above all others?
Ma's sweet pies, Matt said immediately.
Well, it is like that, Sitala said. Knowing that you used to be able to enjoy those pies every day, but now they have been denied you. Your friends, they can have as many of those pies as they want. You envy them, and you hurt. But at the same time, you're happy. At least someone can enjoy what you cannot.
Matt nodded slowly.
Why is it that you hate Aes Sedai so, Master Cawthon? Sitala asked.
I don't hate them, Matt said. Burn me, but I don't. But sometimes a man can't seem to do two things without women wanting him to do one of those things a different way and ignore the other one completely.
You aren't forced to take their advice, and I warrant that much of the time you eventually admit it is good advice.
Matt shrugged.
Sometimes a man just likes to do what he wants without someone telling him what's wrong with it and what's wrong with him. That's all.
And it has nothing to do with your peculiar views of nobles? Most Aes Sedai act as if they were noble women, after all.
I have nothing against nobles, Matt said, straightening his coat. I just don't fancy being one myself.
Why is that, then? Matt sat for a moment. Why was it? Finally, he looked down at his foot, then replaced his boot.
It's boots.
Boots? Sitala looked confused.
Boots, Matt said with a nod, tying his laces. It's all about the boots.
But, you see, Matt said, pulling the laces tight,
a lot of men don't have to worry much about what boots to wear. They're the poorest of folks. If you ask one of them, what boots are you going to wear today, Mop? Their answer is easy. Well, Matt, I only have one pair, so I guess I'm going to wear that pair.
Matt hesitated.
Or I guess they wouldn't say that to you, Sitala, since you're not me and all. They wouldn't call you Matt, you understand?
I understand, she said, sounding amused.
Anyway, for people that have a little coin, the question of which boots to wear is harder. You see, average men like me,
he eyed her,
and I'm an average man, mind you.
Of course you are.
Bloody right I am, Matt said, finishing with his laces and sitting up. An average man might have three pairs of boots. Your third best pair of boots, those are the boots you wear when you're working at something unpleasant. They might rub after a few paces, and they might have a few holes, but they're good enough to keep your footing. You don't mind mucking them up in the fields or the barn.
All right, Sitala said.
Then you have your second best pair of boots, Matt said. Those are your day-to-day boots. You wear those if you are going over to dinner at the neighbor's, or in my case, you wear those if you're going to battle. They're nice boots, give you good footing, and you don't mind being seen in them or anything.
And your best pair of boots? Sitala asked. You wear those to social events, like a ball or dining with a local dignitary?
Balls? Dignitaries? Bloody ashes, woman. I thought you were an innkeeper.
Sitala blushed faintly.
We're not going to any balls, Matt said. But if we had to, I suspect we'd wear our second best pair of boots. If they're good enough for visiting old Lady Hembrew next door, then they're bloody well good enough for stepping on the toes of any woman fool enough to dance with us.
Then what are the best boots for?
Walking, Matt said. Any farmer knows the value of good boots when you go walking a distance.
Satala looked thoughtful. All right. But what does this have to do with being a nobleman?
Everything, Matt said. Don't you see? If you're an average fellow, you know exactly when to use your boots. A man can keep track of three pairs of boots. Life is simple when you have three pairs of boots. But nobleman? Telmanis claims he has 40 different pairs of boots at home. 40 pairs? Can you imagine that?
She smiled in amusement.
40 pairs, Matt repeated, shaking his head. 40 bloody pairs. And they aren't all the same kind of boots either. There's a pair for each outfit, and a dozen pairs in different styles that will match any number of half your outfits. You have boots for kings, boots for high lords, and boots for normal people. You have boots for winter and boots for summer, boots for rainy days and boots for dry days. You have bloody shoes that you wear only when you're walking to the bathing chamber. Lopin used to complain that I didn't have a pair to wear to the privy at night.
I see. So you're using boots as a metaphor for the onus of responsibility and decision placed upon the aristocracy as they assume leadership of complex political and social positions.
Metaphor for... Matt scowled. Bloody ashes, woman. This isn't a metaphor for anything. It's just boots.
Satala shook her head. You're an unconventionally wise man, Matram Cawthon.
I try my best, he noted, reaching for the pitcher of mulled cider. To be unconventional, I mean.
He poured a cup and lifted it in her direction. She accepted graciously and drank, then stood. I will leave you to your own amusements then, Master Cawthon. But if you have made any progress on that gateway for me...
Elaine said she would have one for you soon, in a day or two. Once I'm back from the errand I have to run with Tom and Noel, I'll see it done.
She nodded in understanding. If he did not return from that errand, she would see to Ulver. She turned to leave. Matt waited until she was gone before taking a slurp of the cider straight from the pitcher. He had been doing that all evening, but he figured she would probably rather not know. It was the sort of thing women were better off not thinking about. He turned back to his reports, but soon found his mind wandering to the Tower of Genji and those bloody snakes and foxes. Birgitta's comments had been enlightening, but not particularly encouraging. 2 months? 2 bloody months spent wandering those hallways? That was a mighty steaming bowl of worry served up like afternoon slop. Beyond that, she had taken fire, music, and iron. Breaking the rules was not so original an idea. He was not surprised. Likely, the day the light made the very first man and that man had made the first rule, someone else had thought to break it. People like Elaine made up rules to suit them. People like Matt found ways to get around the stupid rules. Unfortunately, Birgitta, one of the legendary heroes of the Horn, had not been able to defeat the Aelfin and Eelfin. That was disconcerting. Well, Matt had something she had not had. His luck. He sat thoughtfully, leaning back in his chair. One of his soldiers passed by. Clintock saluted. The Red Arm checked on Matt every half hour. They still had not gotten over the shame of letting the Golem sneak into camp. He picked up Varen's letter, feeling it over in his fingers. The worn corners, the smudges of dirt on the once white paper. He tapped it against the wood. Then he tossed it onto the desk. No. No, he was not going to open it, even when he got back. That was that. He would never know what was in it, and he bloody did not care. He stood up and went looking for Tom and Noel. Tomorrow, they would leave for the Tower of Genji.